Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Welcome to GoTo Unscripted. My name is Simon Wardley. I'm here with a panel of lovely people. Adele. Adele, who came along and did some mapping, so a mapper as well. Sorry, I'm just a little biased. I'll throw that in there as well. Mikael, Suzanne, and Eddie, the shipboard computer.
Hi there.
Sorry, it's Dan North. So we're here at GoTo in Amsterdam. This is the first time I've actually been to a conference in Europe for, 5 years. I think the last time was with Eddie, the shipboard computer, where you had an entire floor of a hotel as your room.
They accidentally gave me an entire floor of a hotel. I checked into the hotel, and just you check into the hotel, and it's a really quirky hotel called the Amrath in the city. And they said, oh, you're in room 501. I was like, okay. And I said, no, you're in room 501. Like, how do I get there? You take the lift. So I took the lift. The lift only goes to the fourth floor. Like, where's room 501? So you come out onto the fourth floor, you walk along a corridor, and then there's a separate staircase that goes up because it's a...
To the private thing.
Well, because room 501 is the entire fifth floor. So I went up this private staircase. And you go in, it's like a sort of souk thing. So you go down a couple of steps, big floor area, up a couple of steps the other side. And then into, I won't call it a bedroom, it's a sleeping area, which is this vast four-poster bed. This thing had two balconies. So you go through like a lounge area, a bunch of sofas, opens onto a roof terrace where there's a huge table, you know, maybe 15, 20-seater table out there. And then the other roof terrace, because you can't have too many roof terraces, right? There's a smaller roof terrace over here. And of course, I'm a speaker at a conference. And the first thing I think is, we need a party in this room. So we brought a bunch of people back. And we partied in room 501.
You just turned up to the hotel and it's room 501. You're expecting a small room. You go up and there's a doorbell. It opens and you're trying to think, where's his room? And then you suddenly dawns on you, it's the entire
floor. The whole thing is his room.
Completely mad. But there we are. So how are you finding the conference?
Awesome so far. So it's now the first half day of the first day. So, and I already have a lot of FOMO, fear of missing out for all the talks that I could not attend at the same time. So I'm looking forward to all the recording.
Now you're speaking as well, or you've spoken?
I've spoken. So before lunch, so I'm now relaxed.
And you've spoken as well?
Yes, I'm also already on the relaxed side. There's a panel that I will be on tomorrow. But I'm done and I'm enjoying just the company. I really enjoy connections. I haven't been on a conference for a long time. Like in person, meeting people is such a different experience. So I'm very excited about that one. Yeah.
So you're like me, it's been years since you've been to a sort of event.
Unfortunately. Yeah. Yes.
Adele, you came along to my... I did a workshop yesterday on mapping.
You did. It was excellent.
Oh, thank you.
11 out of 10. Do recommend.
11 out of 10. Fantastic. Thank you very much. That's very
we
kind.
We didn't cover math or percentages.
No, maps. No, not at all. How have you enjoyed it?
Well, disclaimer, I'm on the program committee.
Oh, well, there we are.
I'm taking notes.
Taking notes. Never invite Simon again. He's completely useless.
I'm very proud of the program that we have put together. And I was in Suzanne's talk earlier, and I thoroughly enjoyed that. She put a lot of content, including Wardley mapping, into a 50-minute slot. And I saw another talk from another wonderful speaker, Jody. Security from JetBrains. I was an excellent cutting the hype of LLMs, which I think we could all use a healthy dose of. So I thoroughly enjoyed that talk as well. We just had a great keynote. So I'm very, very proud of the program we put together. None of you have disappointed me yet.
So, I promise I will do tomorrow. But anyway,
it all goes down.
Can always count on you, Simon.
Absolutely. Well, we can talk now about LLMs. We can also talk about your talk. So you you had, I presume this was all about organizational design. Did you take everybody through that?
Yeah, not only organizational design, but also like, you call it architecture for flow. So it's kind of like holistic view on three perspectives of business strategy with water mapping.
Okay.
Of course. Then also software architecture and software design with domain-driven design and team organization with team topologies and bringing them together and also having a water map as a conversation starter to generate a common understanding of the landscape you're operating in. And then also, I'm sorry, I am reusing your water map in totally different ways than
perfectly
you might have originally intended or invented
for. Oh, so I totally, that's fine.
I use water maps in every, I also add layers. I have not presented it yet, only a little bit in this talk, but usually I also added some additional layers going into the domain-driven design perspective from the problem space. Starting with the user need, and then also diving into the solution space where you come then to the components fulfilling the user needs directly and indirectly, and then mapping them to evolution stages to also channel or you to focus your development, your strategic investment in the core domain where also blending in domain-driven design, which comes in with the subdomain types of core domain providing competitive advantage, supporting subdomains and generic subdomains where you can then go towards the right spectrum of a water map, more like, okay, can we use off-the-shelf products or outsource to utility suppliers for those parts of our system that do not differentiate us. And so it's like I combine everything and then also bringing in also the team perspective, like also on a water map and to try to derive some team ownership boundaries with domain-driven design as components, what teams can own, what component on the value chain, and also switching then from the external view to the internal product view to come also to the platform perspective with developer experience is also involved, like product mindset and so on. So it's a combination of these three, bringing them together with a goal to design and build adaptive socio-technical systems.
Look at all the trouble I've caused. I mean, and you've got a book coming out as well.
Yes. So yeah, I announced it already. I'm sorry for the audience. I already announced it, I guess, a couple of years ago, and I was really naive, to be honest. So it was my first book, and it took so much time. But I'm also in a series, signature series of Von Verden, so it also takes until you are the one that gets reviewed, it takes the time as well. So now, but it's moving forward and let's cross fingers. I'm not making any promises when it's going to be published because it's always wrong.
Right.
I can say I'm currently 12 years into my
Oh really, 12 years?
Book.
Amazing.
I actually have a strategy now. I didn't have a strategy for a long time. It was just kind of bibbling along. I just turned into, basically it's got 40 something chapters because it's 40 something patterns, my software faster stuff I've been doing for well over a decade. And I'm working with a brilliant co-author now. And what she's convinced me to do is, because the book is in chunks, and let's just take the team patterns chunks out and just do that as a book about patterns of effective teams, which was a talk I did at GoTo Chicago a few years ago. Mm-hmm. Kind of goes over most of those. We've got a couple more bits in there as well. And it's nearly done. I'm going to publish a book, hopefully this year.
Awesome.
Right? But it's only taken me 12 years and a massive kick up the backside and a brilliant co-author. So you need those two things, I think.
Yeah, that's true.
You see, I have a completely different plan in the fact that once your book is published, that'll be the 17th book with Wardley mapping in, which will go onto my little library, which doesn't include my book because I haven't actually written it yet.
Why didn't you write a BDD book? Goyko wrote a BDD book. John Ferguson Smart wrote a BDD book. Gaspar Nash wrote. There's like some really, really good BDD literature out there. I don't need to write one. Go and read those. They're brilliant.
So, Michaela, you were talking about. You spoke today as well.
Yes.
And you were speaking about DevEx.
Developer experience. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Which is, I'm going to, in my primitive sense, I mean, you're talking about the tool sets we use as developers, which are pretty much all identical, search, edit, navigation, and they're all appalling.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's in the essence what everybody understands around developer experience.
Yeah.
And I think it's also a lot of what comes from the productivity side, right? So what a lot of companies, I mean, developer experience also comes a lot from the companies that are developing software developer tooling, right? But developer experience is such a, so much more, right? So when we set out, I think around 3 years ago, to really study developer experience, and I did a grounded theory study around that, and we really sat down and interviewed people and looked at the topics that emerge, right? The tooling is just a really tiny percentage. It's about the social technical systems that we have, right? So we actually identified 26 different factors around developer experience, and we group them into four categories. One of the biggest is collaboration and culture, right? Like, how supportive are my teammates? How much knowledge sharing is going on? Do I get answers to my questions, right? A lot of things were about product management, right? So it would be more developer focused already, but it's about, do I have clear goals, requirements, right? Can I do my job, actually? And then we had, obviously, the tooling side as well, right? But there was a lot about flow, about can I actually do the stuff without hitting obstacles, right? What about our, you know, feedback loops that we have? So developer experience is so much more about the tooling. I think it's, you know, developer experience, the terminology was a little bit used like UX, user experience, just for tools that are made for developers. But that's not the developer experience that I'm talking about. That's not the research that we are looking at. This is really about how is the team doing, going away from how fast they are. Productivity metrics and measurements are really bad for knowledge workers, right? Coming out of an industrial revolution time, right? Where we measure how fast and how many things can we do, but it's not what we want people to do, right? We don't want them to write a lot of code that's, you know, buggy, and we want to write them good code, innovative code, right? We want them to have creative solutions. And then I'm coming a lot from the research side as well, right? So there's this happiness, there was this productivity research, right? I was heavily involved in that. But there's also the happiness side, right? Which is a little bit fluff, right? It's like table tennis. I mean, I'm now making it a little bit stronger. And developer experience is not about that, right? Developer experience, and I think this is why it's so powerful. I call it doing your best work joyfully. It's really a work focus, right? It's really about thinking the best work, so quality work that you can do, but joyfully, right? So you're getting back all this...
How to make engineering joyful.
Yeah, but also doing really good work, right? And we mapped that back. So what I presented were some statistical analysis results that we got, right? Where we really could show that there's a really strong correlation between the developer experience areas, dimension, right? The factors, and outcomes like creativity, learning, innovation, right? Productivity actually is the outcome, right? The direct outcome from it, tech dev and all of that. Yeah, so.
But isn't that all going away? Because I was talking to a CIO a couple of months ago, and they're intending to get rid of all their developers because they're going to have a prompt and they're going to be able to just type into it, you know, make my legacy system future-proof, and magically OpenAI will solve all their problems.
I tell you, my 8-year-old.
Your 8-year-old?
My 8-year-old told himself to program in Python,
yeah,
completely self-taught, autodidact, with ChatGPT within 3 months. Right?
Wow.
He built a web server. He built a compiler, a tiny compiler, a tiny web server, everything tiny, but it's working, right? So I think AI is super, super powerful, right?
Yeah.
But it's just a tool, right? And it's actually feeding off the information that we are feeding in, right? It's like it's garbage in, garbage out, but also we have a lot of good information, a lot of good, like, code blocks, for example, that it can feed off. So actually there comes working code out of it. And then if you have a person that steers it, and I think this comes back to the industrial revolution, right? It's just, we are even more knowledge workers now, right? Because all of that things that we can actually put into pipelines, right? That we can automate. I think it's brilliant that it's, I mean, we have to be very careful. And there is a lot of things that we, you know, we should guide where it's going, right? And on what information comes out and how we are using it. But I think I'm not scared at all for us developers.
So you don't see it as a replacement?
No, not at all.
As an assistant?
Yes, yeah, yeah. And we have to make sure that we keep it like that, right? Like, we have to keep it in the boundaries of, of itself, right? Yeah.
Unfortunately, there's a lot of executives who think it is a replacement.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Should I be excited or afraid of AI? The answer is yes, it's both.
Things are going to look so different in the next couple years. You will not be ready for the disruptions that are going to come. I'm Jeff Nielsen, host of Digital Disruption, the go-to podcast for technology leaders.
Our generation's conflict, I think, is going to be emotional, not economic.
The companies that are going to win are the ones that have a couple of characteristics.
Stay ahead of the curve with Digital Disruption, available now on your favorite podcast platform.
Well, and this, I mean, my punt on this is, with any technology, the successful technologies are the ones that help people do work better,
yeah,
not the ones that replace work. And like I was saying earlier, Taichi Ono, kind of the architect of the Toyota whole kind of lean production system stuff, you know, he talked about automation, which is automation with a human touch. And he says, you know, machines don't build cars, people build cars with machines, right? And if you have better machines, you can build better cars. If you have machines that you can switch up really quickly, they called it SMED, single minute exchange of die. So you could change the whole machine over in less than a minute. You can build lots of different kinds of cars, but you still need human beings doing that. You know, calculators didn't get rid of accountants. They made accountants much less error prone, right? It meant they could work better. Computers didn't replace administrators. It made admin much easier. You know, and the great tools are the tools that allow people to either do what they need to do better or to do novel things.
Can I add something here?
Yes,
like
sure.
One of the factors of DevX, right, was engaging work. Can you do stimulating and engaging work? And it was very predictive for innovation, for you know, for all the good outcomes that we actually want. And I think if AI takes over the boring tasks, like boilerplate code, right, the surroundings, and you can really focus on creativity, on innovation, on, you know, making sure that the tool actually gives you a good answer, right, and making sure if the answer is even good and testing that, and you know, I think this is amazing, right? It's like, I'm actually quite positive around it, but I obviously see also the problems that we have with it, but it's more from an ethical perspective, I think, where we have to be conscious, right? What kind of information do we feed off? What biases are there in our systems, right? And how do we use that? But with every powerful technology comes a lot of responsibility as well, right? So
no, I agree with that. I think, you know, I look back at, and this is why, you know, I never think of feature parity as a product thing. It's all about experience. I remember for many years, you had Eclipse was this big open source Java editor, and IntelliJ was this big Java editor. And they were like feature parity right down to the detail. And they'd leapfrog each other a little bit. But, you know, you would find working in Eclipse, you could get stuff done. It was just a bit clunky. And working in IntelliJ, you would get the stuff done. It was just really obvious and natural. It just became an extension of you. And you could like basically think Java into the machine. Do you know what I mean? And it's what they did brilliantly was DevX, was the user experience. What does it feel like to be using this tool? If you feel like the tool is on your side. And I guess when I'm building, I've been building trading systems. And like traders do not want to use trading systems. They want to trade. That's what they want to be doing. The trading system is in between them and trading, right? So, you know, if you can make the trading system invisible, you win. Yeah. If you can make the tool feel just so intuitive that it's not even there.
So there was I can't remember the date. I think it was 1972. Nicholas Negroponte published a paper, which was Architecture by Yourself, which was all about when you design, the process of design is a conversation between two designers, sometimes within the head of a single person. And what's interesting about large language models is the system itself is becoming the designer. So it's you're having a conversation with the system to build something. And that's the whole area of conversational programming. But what's fascinating about that space is that a lot of the conversations we're having through things like Copilot are all text-based. And the problem with text alone, as in code, is it's stuck within a world of rules and syntax and style. So is the code right and wrong? How have you written it? But if you look at most engineering departments, the conversation occurs at two different places. One is the screen, and the second conversation is on the whiteboard. And the whiteboard is about objects, relationships, and syntax. So there's very, very different conversations going on whenever we're solving a problem. And we've concentrated on one area, one specific, mm-hmm. and using that as the sort of co-pilot to help us. Now, one of my concerns about this is not only are we training it potentially in the wrong medium, back in 2005, I introduced a structure which is these days known as explorers, villagers, town planners. So basically mapping out environment, breaking into small teams, small cells. And what we noticed is as the components evolved, the attitude you needed. So you had skill sets like engineering, finance, but there is different attitudes. So exploring, when you're exploring, that engineering side is subtly different from sort of like the villager when you're turning things into a product, to the town planners where you're industrializing. And you need three very different attitudes when building something, and they're all really important.
So can confirm, there's also an ego element to this. Okay. I've always wanted to think of myself as like, you know, the pioneer, the explorer, I'm going to go and have all these great ideas. Turns out I'm rubbish. I've had two great ideas in 30 years. Mm-hmm. Two. One of them is questionable. In 30 years, I'm really, really good at growing ideas. I'm really good at taking someone else's thing and growing it. Turns out I'm a brilliant villager, and I kind of really fancied myself as an explorer, and I just don't have an explorer gene in me, but I'm great at villaging. I'm like, I've made my peace with that, but I found that quite difficult.
So, Suzanne, I know you've expanded on this stuff so much.
Yeah.
How do you find large language models and the idea of co-pilots fitting into that?
Yeah, I was thinking, so it's also like when I see it from the team cognitive load perspective, I guess it could be, so it's a great tool like that, increases your efficiencies in terms of like that you can use it like conversational programming, engineering, something like that, and also being your rubber duck when you do pair programming with your co-pilot, for example, but also built on top of large language models in your own value chain that you can build upon, and then you can focus on your core domains or your core capabilities that you would like to focus on. So it can reduce also taking over or reducing potential team cognitive load, and also like coming back to the explorer, villager, and town planner. It's also my personal view is it's a mix of mindset per each team. So where one specific mindset is more prevalent, for example, like the one that tries to explore and discover new things, but they also have some of the other mindset, maybe also because some areas needs to be stabilized, and for example, but also like the teams that own components in commodity which are stable, standardized, more stable, more standardized, but they also have then this town planner mindset to mature and optimize, but they also need to confront specifically when it comes to large language model, when it's new to their platforms, for example, they provide, how they can incorporate in their variety of platform that they provide. So, but they also have to have a kind of like explorer mindset as well, so that they enable those teams to respond to different ways at different situations. So when something's coming new, it's not that this other team's exploring it. It could also be the platform team, even though they are more on owning the stable components in your value chain, they also can say, okay, let's try this out with a little explorer mindset as well, and then see where we can also support the streamlined teams in prompt engineering or something like that. So that is also,
an awful lot of change, an awful lot of, this particular set of technologies impacting the way we think about things, the way we communicate things, the way we work with others, the way we structure. I mean, Adele, I mean, I would imagine conferences going forward, you're going to be bombarded by huge numbers of talk subscriptions all generated by large language models. How do you distinguish between what is actually genuinely human and not? Secondly, of all these sorts of conversation, the whole sort of conversational programming to the organizational structure, fantastic event you put on. What do you think is really important going forward?
Well, the program of GoTo is actually invite only, so we kind of dodge that whole delving into the CFP landscape nonsense.
Well, you still have the Turing test thing, though, right? You still got to know that the person you're contacting exists and isn't just a very clever construct off a Wardley map somewhere.
Yeah, so you make sure they turn profile
view. It's not Eddie the shitball computer.
Exactly. So yeah, we do tend to avoid that, but I do have friends that collect a lot of CFPs, and there was actually a screenshot that was going around that was hilarious, where they had ordered all of the CFP proposals in alphabetical order, and there was just a section that was in this ever-changing landscape, and there was like 30.
Wow. Oh, no.
Yeah. And there's a great video from Dylan B, who's also well known to the GoTo team. He did a video recently actually on that phenomenon of CFPs and the change in words that have been used. So a word like delve, for example, had a very low usage rate pre 2022 in CFPs. And now, last year, it's gone up orders of magnitude, the usage of that word. So it's quite amusing to see. But, yeah, personally...
So you just broke out the word delve, and that's like all of your LLMs.
Basically, yeah. Also, colons in subjects or in talk titles is also a bit of a giveaway as well.
Oh, I've got one of those. I might be an LLM.
No, me too.
I just need to go check some things.
That brings us all the way back to Eddie the shipboard computer. So I've got to say...
I'm busy right now. I'm trying to make a cup of tea.
Right. So all I can say is thank you ever so much. Thank you for joining us for this very unscripted GoTo talk. You've been absolute stars. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.